Good afternoon.
Good morning, Your Honor. May it please the Court, Dan Folt, joined by my colleague Matt Niederman of the law firm Duane Morris, here today on behalf of Mr. Archie Lingo. With the Court's permission, simply to avoid confusion in this matter, I'd like to refer to Mr. Archie Lingo and Ms. Dinah Lingo as Archie and Dinah, as we've done below, not out of casualness or disrespect, but simply to make it easier for purposes of reference. Thank you. This Court is certainly familiar with the expression that equity will suffer no wrong without a remedy. It's often invoked in many of our Delaware courts, but we think this case will test that maxim like no other. The reason we say that is because there appears in this case something that we haven't seen in a lot of cases actually in Delaware or anywhere, and that is really two directly competing policies. The competing policy that is very well respected in this Court, that we honor and give effect to testamentary intent on one hand, and the other policy where in dealing with breaches of fiduciary duty our courts try to fashion appropriate relief. Those policies overlap here. Ostensibly they conflict.
Let me ask you a question about your underlying premise. We've seen often quoted, every wrong deserves a remedy or every wrong has a remedy. Let's assume for sake of argument that Dinah was a faithless fiduciary, as the Court of Chancery found. What was the harm after restitution that flowed from that faithlessness?
The harm would be principally financial, perhaps exhaustively financial. I haven't thought of the question exactly the way you phrased it. But very, very difficult harm to calculate, because one of the findings that was upheld and not challenged by anyone is that the bookkeeping was not well done. And it is going to be impossible in many respects to really ultimately sort out in an accurate and true measure the financial harm here. For example...
Well, but the financial harm to whom?
Well, the financial harm would result to both of them, and this is why. One of the problems in bookkeeping is that it is going to be impossible really effectively to trace the source, even though Vice Chancellor Laster, correctly in our view, ordered that. The Prince of County has been going on. The records are so bad, and the commingling is so extensive, it's very hard to separate money or funds that would have gone into the trust or would have gone in to the personal estate of Miss Eleanor Lingo. And if you take that into account, the problem is that if you give effect, as the Court found, and we haven't challenged, that the distribution should be 75-25, if all those funds that are recovered go back into the personal estate, Archie will take zero. If they go back into the trust estate, he would receive 25%, functionally 25%
of
that.
So you're talking about a difficult accounting problem, right?
Yes, I think that's a fair assessment of what I'm saying.
And why is the remedy that the Court provided in this case not able to deal with that difficult accounting problem?
The reason why it won't be able to deal with that is because the problem is beyond the powers of the Court and the forensic accountants, where there has been conduct going on for 5, 6, 7 years, and there's simply no records by which any hardworking forensic accountant can recreate and put together the finances. We'll never really know the extent. If I could give just one very brief example, it was, I don't believe these were challenged findings below, but there was approximately during the years of Dinah's management of the business, $1.3 million in gross rental receipts. But at the end of the same period, the accretion was simply $17,000 into the checking account. We're never, ever, and believe me, we tried hiring people and doing it, we're never going to be able to put that back together.
Mr. Folt, let me ask you a hypothetical question. Let's assume that whatever dollars that Dinah took from her mom, from the trust or whatever, could be precisely traced, and by order of the Court was restored every penny plus whatever would be the appropriate rate of interest to compensate for the premature use of that money. If that had happened, would that be an adequate remedy?
Your Honor phrases the million-dollar tough question. Our position is no.
Why not?
And our position is that there was misconduct here, gross misconduct.
Well, let's, before you get any further, if this were, let's say, a trust case, and Dyna were the trustee and took $1 million out of the trust estate, under traditional fiduciary analysis, the remedy would be that she has to restore that money plus any interest, and if she made any profit above and beyond that, that profit would have to be disgorged.
Absolutely correct.
And I don't know that anyone has ever, in those circumstances, would say that that is an inadequate remedy. Although, in those circumstances, there may be grounds to discharge, Dyna is the trustee. But we have a different circumstance here.
We do. Your Honor's right. And this court may well find that, setting aside any tracing or accounting or source issues, that the restitutionary remedy, well, it doesn't create any real practical or have any true net economic effect is sufficient. We've looked at the law, and you can look at some analogs, and you say if you accept the worst of the misconduct found by the courts below, it's pretty serious conduct. Should that be punishable in an equitable court? Can you conceive of wrongs for which there ought to be remedies? Our law says, general principles from this court's decisions, that there sometimes are cases with unique and specific facts that present unusual circumstances.
Right, but if where you're going is leads to a forfeiture in whole or in part of Dyna's economic interest, that has to be anchored to either a principle of law or some principle of equity, does it not?
Yes.
And can you identify what that principle would be?
Yes.
The Vice Chancellor could not.
And the Vice Chancellor could not for a number of reasons. I'll address those. I don't even need to refer to his opinion. So the first thing that he said the remedy wasn't illusory because the benefit was restored to Eleanor. But Eleanor died, no money was returned. That was the reason he gave in his decision, I think pages 7 or 8, and there wasn't any return of funds during her lifetime. So that, the reason given by the Vice Chancellor as to why the remedy was not illusory did not take place. There are many contexts in which harms exist that are different to calculate. Just off the top of my head, not even anticipate this question, trespass. So you can get nominal damages for trespass. Maybe you get more than nominal damages outside of trespass. Defamation. Defamation per se, impossible really to calculate in any scientific way. The injury to reputation, but courts deal with that. Delaware courts, with the longest history in the country of dealing with equitable wrongs, ought to have a remedy if you have a situation like this, where somebody comes in, manipulates medical control, takes advantage of the person whom they're supposed to protect, and at a time when that person, Eleanor, is powerless to defend herself, and then because of that gains advantages where the victim can't speak for himself, and because of that, at the end of that point in time, is benefited. Now, the benefit isn't just financial. It isn't just calculating the dollars and cents. There's a time value of money. There's a lifestyle that was obtained. There was a lot of, I think, intangible advantages to taking over that plan.
But, Mr. Folt, when all is said and done, aren't you asking the court to rewrite Eleanor's will and to not give effect to what she wanted to do in disposing of her assets, and to make that change not because of anything she has been established to have, been undue influence or incompetent or anything like that, but to make that change in order to punish Dyna appropriately deal with her wrongdoing so that your client can inherit everything. So aren't we really talking about finding a way to change the will?
I was going to answer no and yes, but the last part of that question threw me off. We're not asking the court to rewrite the will. I agree with our friends that that's not appropriate. That's not what our courts do. But what do our courts do when a situation occurs? I think you still think it's a novel situation where somebody puts a will in. And look, we accept she chose to disinherit Arshilingo. We challenged that. We were not successful under the burdens, and we respect and accept and did not appeal that decision. So we shouldn't be giving, as our friends will say, a windfall to Mr. Lingo. That's why we hesitated, I hesitated in talking to Vice Chancellor Laster about whether I really even wanted to say a full equitable forfeiture. I thought about a partial equitable forfeiture. How can we reconcile these policies between honoring testamentary intent, not rewriting wills, things our courts will not do, with this misconduct here?
Let me put it another way. Let's assume that instead of Eleanor passing away as the decision was being made, I gather, let's assume that Eleanor managed to live another 5 to 10 years after the court adjudicated the wrongdoing of Dinah and after everyone did the analysis and did the best they could to recover and trace all the assets, perhaps giving the benefit of the doubt to the recipient, to Eleanor. Whenever there was no records, it meant that Eleanor deserved it and so forth. Why would that not have been an entirely complete and appropriate remedy? And if that would have been an appropriate remedy, then does it make any difference that Eleanor died very quickly?
I think it makes a difference because I would at least suggest to the court for consideration it's a question of degree. If, in fact, the way Mr. Lingo actually prevailed in a lot of these things, although it wasn't economically accretive for him, he got a guardianship, he took care of his mother. Dinah was not entrusted to make life decisions for cause. He got an independent trustee over the property, so if there had been some life there, there would have been real value to that. And so I think in terms of degree, our argument that this extended as any sustenance would be weakened. In this case, it's different. If I could just, I think I really would ask the court, and the court may have already done this, focus on what Eleanor would think. If we accept, as all the courts did below, and we have accepted, that Eleanor chose to disinherit Archie for these reasons, which her words were, I believe, money-grubbing ways, that's a quote from the will, and the only findings that Mr. Lingo had against him were that Eleanor didn't take a salary when she was at the market, that he might have misled a divorce court, which was an awful thing to do that he did, unrelated to this case, in the 90s, that the siblings had mutual antipathy, they reciprocated hostility. There was a public brawl. Actually, it's a record fact. Dinah was arrested and pled guilty in that. Those are the things that Archie was found to have done, and we know the reasons why Eleanor disinherited him. But what is it fair to ask the question, what would Eleanor think if she, who everyone agreed and the master found, and Vice Chancellor Laster upheld, she was frugal? What would she have done if she'd known that she was withheld medical help? The person who lived with her, who knew she was confused, could have gotten her a drug that would have brought her lucidity and enhanced moments in her life, given her memories, commingled funds, took salaries, bought boyfriends'
Mr.
gifts.
Mr. Fault, let me interrupt you. If you were in this court today arguing that all of the funds that were misappropriated by Dinah should be given to the American Cancer Society, then it would raise interesting questions, but at least at that point I would be saying, okay, this litigant is trying to do something, to accomplish something that is more equitable than allowing the wrongdoer to receive the same thing that she stole from her mother to begin with. But you're not asking that. You're asking that the money go to the other child who was disinherited. So I'm having a lot of trouble figuring out why it becomes equitable to do something contrary to Eleanor's will, because it's important that we punish Dinah.
Should I have suggested IOLTA? No, just kidding. That's a huge problem. I understand the court's concern over that. That's why
the Vice Chancellor addressed it. he focused right on that very point and said there's nothing in the record that suggests to him that the testatrix would have acted any differently had she known about that, or that she had another beneficiary in mind, either family or a favorite charity. So where can we go with that if there's nothing in the record to support an alternative?
Chief Justice, I think that he actually said he didn't know which way she'd go. I think Vice Chancellor Laster said she might disinherit one, might disinherit both, might give to a charity. He said, how do I determine that this time?
And that's my very question.
What we say is if you look at her life and her conduct and her course of living, which was unchallenged, it's a pretty safe bet she'd do something. So with 20 seconds left, what I would say is what can the court do? It's really hard. We weren't telling any court what remedy to give. We were asking the Delaware court with Delaware court system with its powers to frame a remedy. One could be fee shifting. And you know what? There has to be, as a policy matter, some incentive for people to bring this misconduct to light. But right now, an application was made just to recover one-third of the fees, and that was denied. Now there's something going on where small fees will be awarded. But if no, my time has expired, so perhaps I could take this up in my rebuttal.
All right.
Thank you, Your Honor.
May it please the Court. Richard Zappa, along with my colleagues Joseph Nicholson and Lauren Hudecki, for the defendant below, Appellee Dinah Lingo. Your Honors, our position is that it was not legal error and it cannot be legal error for the Court of Chancery, an equity court with broad discretion to fashion remedies for the kinds of fiduciary breaches involved in this case, to order the time-honored remedy of restitution to the party harmed, who is Eleanor Lingo in this case, and to reject a remedy fashioned by the plaintiff that would invalidate a legitimate inheritance and then pay it over to himself, a remedy that, if imposed in this case, would violate the terms of both Eleanor Lingo's will and William Lingo's testamentary trust.
Well, it seemed to me that one of your colleagues' issues was there's a difference between the money that was in the trust and the money that was to be inherited from the testatrix personal estate. Should they be treated differently?
Your Honor, no. Yes, in this sense, that all income generated from Lingo Brother Reynolds, which is generated from properties co-owned between the trust and Eleanor Lingo individually, belongs to Eleanor Lingo. It is all her income. It is supposed to be distributed to her annually after the payment of legitimate trust-related expenses. So the trust isn't entitled to receive the income. There never was any harm to the trust, and therefore never any harm to Archie Lingo as a result of anything that Dinah Lingo did in this case.
Well, the Vice Chancellor talked about disgorgement in the event that the record showed that Dinah had taken income to herself to which her mother was otherwise entitled from the trust, that she would have to disgorge that profit and put it back into the trust.
That is correct.
Now, on Eleanor's death, what happens to the corpus of the trust?
Now, the corpus of the trust gets distributed to both Dinah and Archie Lingo in equal shares. The trust assets, you have to understand what the trust corpus is. It's Wilmington Trust Company stock that had never been touched for 28 years. And a 50% interest in real estate that was never the subject of any waste or devaluation by anything that Dinah Lingo did. What Dinah Lingo did was take money from her mother for which she had no informed consent given to her mother. That's what she did. And she titled properties into her name. She thought with her mother's permission, but the court found that they'd have to be returned to Eleanor Lincoln. Now, our position is that contrary to what the plaintiff says, there isn't, in order for the plaintiff to prevail, he has to show that the remedy ordered in this case violated some statute or rule of court, which we know it did not, or violated some principle of law or equity rooted in, or at least reasonably established by application, in the judicial precedents of this court or in the Court of Chancery. And yet, the plaintiff can point to no court in Delaware or nationwide where the extreme remedy of forfeiture of a legitimate inheritance was ordered in a breach of trust case or a breach of fiduciary duty case and then paid over to the party who was not harmed and expressly disinherited in the will. That's a pretty tall order to ask for. And contrary to what the plaintiff suggests, this maxim inequity that every wrong must or should have a remedy, well, you know, as hallowed as those words are, I respectfully say that they're theoretical. There are many wrongs that have no remedy, for which we have a legislative body that enacts laws to create a remedy where one did not heretofore exist. And we have that example in one of the cases they cite, the state of Newman, where they have an elaborate statute designed to achieve a remedy that did not, before its passage, exist in the state of Arizona.
That's a forfeiture statute, right?
That is correct. So in this case, Your Honors, the remedy was not illusory. Neither the master nor the vice chancellor found that it was.
Well, Mr. Zappa, Mr. Fault's argument is not without equitable appeal. I mean, if I understand it correctly, it is that if the mother had survived and had learned of what her daughter had done and what the court had to do to rectify it, then it is possible, likely, that she would have disinherited Diana, either in whole, or in part. Maybe. Because of that possibility, there ought to be some remedy apart from disgorgement. It's from that point on, you know, that the other side has a problem, at least in terms of the existing law. And so I gather that what we're being asked to do is to craft some sort of doctrine to create that additional remedy, to take into account at least the possibility that the mother, had she survived, would have changed her will.
That's a possibility, but, Your Honor, I respectfully dissent from that view. It's just as possible, if not more likely than not, that she would have forgiven her daughter. Let's keep in mind the court found that, ruled that Dinah Lingo, the evil thief that is portrayed by the plaintiff's advocates, was indeed a loving and caring daughter who intended to take care of her mother and, in fact, did, and made her the sole physical custodian and paid her to do it, a salary commensurate to what she was getting, she took for herself during the years in question. So I ask you, Your Honor, is it more likely that the mother would say to her daughter, gee, you know, you shouldn't have done what you did. Now that I understand what you did, you should have asked me first. Nobody is condoning a child picking the pocketbook of her mother earlier than she should to get her allowance. But is it going to rise to the level where we're going to legislate from the court a remedy of forfeiture of a legal inheritance?
Well, to the extent legislating by the court is a problem for you, it isn't for me. We're talking about equity, and equity is well-rooted in the common law. The worst thing that can happen to principles of equity is for the legislature to intervene. Here, as I understand the argument, it is not that there hasn't been a remedy fashioned of sorts, but given the circumstances and the context of this case, it's wholly inadequate. And the remedy that's supposed to apply in the event of a wrong in equity, in the absence of an adequate remedy at law, is an adequate remedy in equity. So the point that, yes, they ordered restitution, yes, the court ordered disgorgement, at least as far as the trust is concerned, put aside the testatrix's intentions, how do you carry out that remedy effectively? Or do we just close our eyes to the fact there's no effective way of enforcing that remedy?
Well, it brings into play a couple of things. First of all, Your Honor, the remedy, when it was imposed, as all remedies must at a given point in time, was promptly acted on. And Eleanor Lingo was restored to the substantial bulk of assets. There were two checking accounts having hundreds of thousands of dollars in them that were titled back to the property guardian for the sole and exclusive use of Eleanor during her lifetime. There was even a joint investment account with Wilmington Trust Company stock having a value before the Great Recession of over $1 million that was jointly owned with rights of survivorship, an ownership interest compatible with her will, Eleanor Lingo's will. That was turned back over to the property guardian. So restitution was in part accomplished, a substantial part. It was just the income that hadn't, and it was an enforceable remedy as to that. Eleanor's property guardian and her personal representative could have enforced that collection against Dinah if Dinah predeceased her mother. That's hardly an illusory remedy. To go to where the plaintiffs asked this court to go requires ignoring four governing principles of equity. And they are, first and foremost, that in a breach of trust case or fiduciary breach case, generally speaking, the goal of the equity court is to bring the parties back to their pre-breach state. Now, having recognized that Eleanor's death intervened to moot out the requirement to pay back to the estate, there still are three other governing principles. One is that equity abhors forfeitures, so much so that the third governing principle is that wills will not be changed. The testamentary dispositions will not be changed if the will is valid and the testamentary intent is clear, which it could not be clearer in this case, that she intended to have all, not just part of her estate to go to her daughter upon her death, but that she didn't want an undeserving and disrespectful son who took financial advantage of her for so many years to inherit from her. And the last principle is this one, and it's an important one, because it really is what the plaintiff is asking for. The plaintiff wants an award of punitive damages because it's payment over to a party not harmed by the misconduct, and taking something, physically taking and denying the legal right to somebody in terms of the money that she would ordinarily inherit. And the court,
help me out with that point. I understand that as it applies to the testamentary estate. I've heard two things this morning. One, that the trust was to be divided 75-25, and the other, that it was to be divided 50-50. Maybe I just misheard. But to the extent all the monies cannot be returned to the trust, isn't someone harmed?
No. The only person that's harmed under the Bill Lingo Testamentary Trust is Eleanor Lingo, because all of the income generated from the trust-owned properties, not 50% or 75%, but 100%, is to be distributed annually to Eleanor Lingo after the payment of necessary trust expenses. Half of it goes instantly to Eleanor because she owned half of the
property. But Eleanor's not here. What happens upon her death to the income from the trust?
There is no income from the trust. Well, right now it goes 75-25 because of the respective interests of the parties in the real estate. As a matter of law, Dinah Lingo succeeded to 75%.
Is your point that any inventory of the assets of the trust, any accounting of income from that trust that could have been accumulated over time but not paid out to Eleanor, that can all be easily determined in order to decide what is the number for 25% of the trust and what is the number for 75% of the trust?
Your Honor, the monies that they're talking about, that was the subject of the forensic accounting, has nothing to do with retained income in the trust that is to be distributed when the trust ends. It is money that was, in fact, paid out to either Eleanor and misappropriated by Dinah, or diverted by Dinah and used for her personal expenses during a given period of time that predates her death. So none of that income is retained income that would be that Archie Lingo has any interest in whatsoever. It's wholly and now completely the property of the estate of Eleanor Lingo.
Let me just follow up on the Chief Justice's question. Is it factually correct that all of the money that was wrongfully diverted, whether it be directly from the mother, Eleanor, or from the trust, has been restored?
It has not. There's been about, I think the forensic accounting indicated was about $320,000 worth of income that he determined was used for Dinah, or used by Dinah for other things. And that was income that was used by Dinah between August of 2002 and February of 2007. And it was used for, we would submit, benign uses.
All right, now I'm confused. I thought that during her lifetime, Eleanor was entitled to all of the income from the trust.
Correct.
Okay, so if we assume that during the last several years, some or all of that income that should have gone to Eleanor got diverted to Dinah, that makes no difference because it was Eleanor's loss, and we can assume that Eleanor would have had that money in a bank account if Dinah hadn't taken it, and
correct,
then it would have passed to Dinah through the will.
Precisely.
Okay, and now that Eleanor is dead, the trust is divided 50-50, right?
The trust corpus is distributed 50-50.
Okay, And nothing about what Dinah has done in breach of her fiduciary duties impacts what is in that trust right now and how it gets divided.
That is absolutely correct. There was no waste with respect to the trust properties. The master found that there was that monies that would have been retained in the operating account would not have been used to reinvest in properties to improve their value. Indeed, Eleanor Linger for 25 years ran this trust even though she had co-trustees and never did so with her share or the share that was in the account.
Okay, thank you.
So we talked about, Your Honor, the four governing principles that we think justify the remedy that was ordered in this case and speak against forfeiture. But ultimately, we ask that the court, you know, see this request for what it really is. And I'm an advocate for my clients, so I have to say it the way we believe it to be. There was a finding by the master, whose findings were unchallenged and adopted by the vice chancellor, that the reasons for bringing the lawsuit were motivated by two of the cardinal sins, hatred and greed. And it was Archie's hatred for his sister, of his sister, and his desire to get a chunk of his mother's estate that she didn't want him to have. He lost the issue. This case was really about the validity of Eleanor Lingo's will. That's what it was from start to finish. There were every conceivable attack against the will was made, that it was fraudulently procured, that it was improperly executed, that it was intentionally altered, that it was a forgery, that it was out the requisite testamentary capacity, and that it was the product of the undue influences of Dinah, none of which were proved. The plaintiff asked for restitution to the parties harmed throughout the case in a trial. It was only until the ruling came down that the will was valid, that this remedy was suddenly the subject of an exception because he lost the case and he could not get a share of his mother's estate. We think that that motivated the case, that was seen by the master who had to look at the competing equities, and there were competing equities. How do you punish Dinah for her wrongdoing? But at the same time, are you going to give it to somebody who no way, shape, or about it, was despised by the testator? Or were you going to honor the will? Now, restitution could have resulted in, I think Justice Berger asked, well, what if Eleanor Lingo had lived 10 years and it had all been paid back and everything was hunky-dory? Well, yes. I mean, it was theoretical. It was fate that intervened that Eleanor died when she did and sort of magnified the issue of not having to repay it. But it still doesn't mean that we have to disregard a rule of law that we follow in this court. That is, that the will be, if it's valid, will be honored. So for those reasons, Your Honors, we ask that the remedy be affirmed and that Archie Lingo, the plaintiff, not be allowed to do indirectly that which he could not do directly, and that it's get a share of his father's personal estate. Thank you.
Thank you.
Four short points in summary. We'll get through them, Your Honors. The question is, what's the remedy? I would defer to this court in fashioning remedies. Fee shifting is a possibility, a partial equitable forfeiture, nowhere in scale to rewriting the will, is a possibility. More important than identifying what specific remedy ought to apply in our mind is what policy factors should inform the choice. I think Vice Chancellor Laster correctly pointed out the need, if we're going to do that, to have a roadmap. Maybe this is the law Justice Jacobs was referring to that the court could create or find in its inherent equitable powers. The word the Court of Chancery used was guideposts, the need for guideposts, and here are some we could suggest, just brainstorming, who speaks for a powerless victim like Eleanor. If we just assume, hypothetically, that you take a situation where my mother becomes incapacitated, and at a time when she becomes incapacitated, I move in with her and I start doing all sorts of terrible things for 5 years, and then she passes away. Who speaks for her and her interests? Do we even get to ask that question? Who stands up for the next Eleanor Lingo after this case and this decision? What incentive will there be? Over $1.2, $1.3 million was spent here that won't be recovered. It's true that Master Glasscock found correctly, I believe, that hatred and greed were motivating factors in this action, but they were not the only factors, and he never said that they were. What message, what incentive, and why would Dinah act any differently if nothing happens here? Those are the factors that we think would influence, if at all, if we're successful, looking at the court's inherent equitable powers and affecting an appropriate remedy. And finally, I'd like to move to a point raised by Justice Berger, and that is on the accounting and all of the income and the net and the gross income. This case is different. If we come back full circle from the hypothetical Justice Jacobs gave me, and we remember that you Humpty Dumpty's fallen off the wall, we're never going to be able to put this forensic accounting back again. If the funds taken go to the trust, that's one outcome. If they go to her estate, that's another. Now, this exact same question Justice Berger raised was raised before Vice Chancellor Laster, and he said there is a difference. There's a difference between income that goes into the trust account and net income. The trust has expenses. The trust spends money. Trust funds were spent as trust funds to give to her friends, to buy gifts as compensation for projects performed badly or not at all. At least in the court's opinion affirming the master, that was recognized as a difference. Now, this court may not find that difference, but we think that there was cause to recognize that difference, because in this case, apart from the larger issue, which is a policy issue, there's no question that the income, the various funds that were spent were not all purely net income of Eleanor Lingo, and so Mr. Lingo, be he a good or bad person, suffered a diminution in what he would receive. Finally, Your Honors, there was discussion about who's the good guy and who's the bad guy. We've never said in one paper or before any court that our client, and he's here in this room today, was a model citizen. He knows that. He's heard that from me personally. These trust cases, this court knows better than I do, particularly the members who all of whom served in the Court of Chancery, are often unpleasant. But there was some real unpleasantness that deserves to be unpunished. Holding back medications that would deprive someone of their lucidity, manipulating drugs to get them through a deposition, lying in court. I'm an ex-cop and an ex-prosecutor, in a different mind would have found at least two felonies in Delaware for this conduct. Now, that didn't happen. We didn't operate under a proof beyond reasonable doubt standard. That wasn't the point here. But the courts below found just really horrific conduct. If nothing happens in this case, if equity cannot fashion a remedy better than what happens here, I fear for what the people that inevitably will confront these type of choices will decide next time. I don't think the outcome's one anyone here would like. If no further questions, I thank the court for its time and patience.
Thank you, counsel. We'll take the case under advisement and adjourn.